studying the Muqaddimat in the Sutuh, for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language, is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our dear guest speaker in this program. Well, we're going to talk about the rules and jurisprudential status of the prayers and some of its necessary or obligatory ingredients, such as muwalat, for example. Sheikh Javed, what does this terminology, muwalat, mean, in fact, in prayer? We all know that, you know, this is one of the obligatory conditions, if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong. And without it, without muwalat, in fact, the prayer is going to be rendered void, right?
Yeah.
Well, can you explain and shed more light on the meaning of muwalat, the concept of muwalat, and how should one go about it?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Well, muwalat is one of the requirements of prayer which must be fulfilled.
Yes.
And if this requirement is not fulfilled, obviously the prayer which people, or let's say the people, the prayer which you offer will be affected.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what does muwalat mean? Muwalat means to offer the different parts of the prayer in quick succession.
No. Right.
They have to be offered and
in order.
And the words and ayat of the prayers should be offered in order in succession, in quick succession, not allowing any gap between one word or any other. So now a person, according to the religious authorities, a duty-bound person should maintain continuity, and I'm going to explain further, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Maintain continuity during prayers. In other words, he should perform the various acts of prayer, like, for example, ruku, sujood, tashahud, in continuous succession. And he should not, of course, he should recite the zikr, and also all the verses, because like, for example, if you're reciting Hamd in Surah, there are verses that you need to recite. Those verses must be recited in the usual succession, mm-hmm. not very fast, and not allowing a big gap between the verses.
I see.
And if a person allows, you know, an undue interval or gap between different acts and different parts of the prayer in a way such that you are not considered to be you are not seen as someone offering prayers, then your prayer will definitely become void. Now, if a person who is offering prayer forgetfully, for example, allows a gap between letters or words, and if the gap is not big enough so that the form of the prayers is disrupted or disturbed, of course, he should repeat the prayers, because mm-hmm. that is happening forgetfully and by mistake. So if a mistake happens, and if there is no deliberate act on the part of the person who is duty-bound,
mm-hmm.
and he allows a kind of gap between the words and the letters, then obviously he should repeat the prayers, unless he has moved on to the next rukun,
mm-hmm.
because a rukun cannot be repeated. It cannot be, you cannot add a rukun to the prayer.
Or delete it.
Yeah, it cannot be, let's say, deleted or ignored under any circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have, for example, gone into sujood and you have made a mistake in the mu'alat or in the recitation of a zikr before the sujood, you cannot go back and you cannot repeat the zikr, or you cannot make it up, you know. So you should ignore what has gone by or what you have already done, because the prayer is not affected. That's in the case of forgetfulness or if a mistake happens. But if you deliberately allow a gap between the different words and different acts of prayer, obviously your prayer will be affected and will be rendered invalid.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. Let's take a quick break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Chaud, hosting, and our dear guest speaker, Sheikh Javed. Well, we are talking about the very important topic, the pillar of Islam, prayer, the rules of prayer, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And Sheikh Javed, before the break, you were talking about what Mawalat is or what it means, in fact. And you also mentioned that, this is kind of quick succession of or order of the acts and words of the prayer, right?
Yeah.
Well, but would you also tell our dear audience about, how would you compare the balance which we are required of offering and performing and observing in the prayer, for example, between the ruku and then the sujood? Then you have to stand up, right? And you need to just pause for a little and then go for the prostration and sujood, right?
Yeah.
So how would you compare and contrast this kind of balance, this kind of short pause, and the concept that you said about muwalat, against which makes the prayer void? You said that if it is too long, then the prayer becomes void, right?
I didn't say that. I said that on the interval,
the interval between the two acts
is too long, in a way that you are not seen as someone praying,
mm-hmm.
you are just silent,
yes.
Then of course your prayer becomes mm-hmm. wide. But when it comes to prolonging your, you know, sajda or prolonging your ruku,
yes.
and you are continuously reading or reciting a zikr, that prolongation, if I can, mm-hmm. if I could term it, does not affect the prayer, no matter how long the sajda, lasts,
yes.
Or the ruku lasts. The act of prolonging the ruku and sujood will not affect the prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if your ruku or sujood are very short, they shouldn't be as short as you will not be able to recite a zikr. Because when you are, the ruku and sujood are not only mere, bending and going down and prostrating, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You have to recite a zikr. And when you are reciting a zikr, your body should be steady, your body should be motionless and should be still.
Mm-hmm.
And in the time of recitation, there should not be any movement, vigorous movement,
yes.
of the body.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, your prayer, as we discussed it in one of the previous episodes, the prayer will be affected.
Mm-hmm.
So during that state of steadiness, and when your body is steady, you should recite the zikr. You
yes.
should recite the zikr. So that much steadiness should be there in order to allow you to recite the zikr. And when your body is moving, it's not permissible to recite the zikr because steadiness is one of the essential conditions and one of the necessary requirements of the prayer, without which the prayer is definitely affected.
Sheikh Sawid, very quick answer I want you to just give our audience about the criteria or the rulers we have regarding prolongation of the ruku and sujood. How long can a ruku or a sujood, a genuflection or a prostration be?
Well, I should say that according to Supreme Leader, and based on what I understand from the fatwa of His Eminence, he gives a general fatwa saying that prolonging sajda and ruku does not break mawlaat, it does not affect mawlaat, but obviously the rukus and sujood should not be so long,
mm-hmm.
and so it should not be protracted so much to that extent that it's no longer considered mm-hmm. an act of ruku, because ruku and sujood have their own formula, shape, and what people understand from ruku is to just bend down and do a respect, recite a zikr out of respect for God, because you are facing God and you are communicating mm-hmm. with Allah.
Okay.
And of course, it shouldn't be very long.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Thank you for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم من جاء لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Travelers who never arrived at their destination. The Persian Gulf, near the Strait of Hormuz, 7:45 a.m., July 3rd, 1988. One of the helicopters of the U.S. cruiser, Vincennes, reports that Iranian boats are hovering around a German cargo vessel. The Vincennes cruiser moves quickly towards the German cargo vessel without being asked.
we remain alert and we'll stay alert. But at the same time, I don't want to ever give the impression that we're leaning forward on our toes to get a major conflagration started here. That's not the case at all.
The war that the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein started on the last day of the summer of 1980 against Iran entered its eighth year. Throughout these years, the Iranians wanted to put an end to the war through winning the land war. From the second year of the war onwards, they had been always far superior to the Iraqi army on the battlefield after being surprised by the beginning of the war. Operation Karbala 5 took place in early 1987. At the end of the bloody Operation Karbala 5, Iran had a superior position and was able to penetrate through the defensive line of Shalamcheh. The progress of Iranian forces towards Basra resulted in significant outcomes. The United States sent the aircraft carrier USS John F. Kennedy to the Persian Gulf to prevent the defeat of Iraq and the fall of Basra. Die Welt and Spiegel wrote that the United States was ready to fight Iran with 6 battalions in 600 warplanes in the event of the collapse of Basra. The Soviet Union also expressed its concern over the continuation of the war and stressed that the war had to be eventually ended with negotiated settlements. Perhaps the Iranians will never forget the statement of the Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger. Weinberger said, "Iranian people should be exterminated by cutting off Iran's oil production so that the war will be over." And years later, Secretary General of the United Nations, Javier Perez de Cuellar, wrote in his memoirs, "Following the adoption of Resolution 598 in July 1987, the United States definitely believed in order to end the war, 1. The Iraqis had to firmly stand against Iran's victory. 2. The war had to be more painful for Iranians than any other time. 3. The flow of weapons to Iran had to be reduced through another resolution within the Security Council. And 4. There had to be a great deal of international pressure on this country." In 1987, the Persian Gulf was the scene of the confrontation between Iran and the United States of America, in which many heartbreaking and painful incidents took place. In the spring of 1988, Iran was going through a tough situation. After the fall of Al-Fah, the U.S. government announced that it would support not only Kuwaiti and Saudi ships, but also other countries' ships and, in general, shipping in the Persian Gulf. They officially announced that all Iranian leaders had to know that the continuation of attacks in the Persian Gulf would not be tolerated.
On the morning of July the 3rd, we were coming back through the Straits of Hormuz on the way to pick up another ship for an Ernest Will escort mission. And there was some radio communications indicating sounds of explosions or such coming from Montgomery and Vincennes.
German merchant Ulagari, this is U.S. Navy warship. We are standing by channel 1-6. Over.
Okay, 1-6. Do you read me?
Merchant Ulagari, this is U.S. Navy warship. We'll read you loud and clear. Over.
Okay, thank you.
On the morning of July 3rd, Captain McKenna, chief of the U.S. Naval Operations Center, was startled to discover that Vincennes' cruiser had moved away about 64 kilometers from where it was supposed to be. Then he promptly ordered Vincennes and Montgomery back south to their original location.
It was our concern, however, that Vincennes was acting in an overly aggressive fashion, or so it seemed, and that they were actually pursuing these boats rather than being pursued by them.
350.
The IRGC were sort of a ragamuffin band, if you will. I mean, they were not very well coordinated, and certainly it wouldn't be too difficult to scare them, I don't think, into doing something that was foolhardy. If they saw a lot of military machinery bearing down on them, they could easily become frightened. It was our business out there to defend shipping against those guys, but not to provoke them.
We don't know how close to the boats the helicopter actually went. There was, without getting too technical, a fixed distance that they were supposed to maintain. If, in fact, they were harassing the boats, which may have been the case, how would the boats communicate with them? Well, they would generally fire warning shots. We'd seen that happen with news helicopters there in the past. If the news helicopters or the media helicopters got too close to Iranian small boats, bog hammers, if you will, or whatever, warning shots would be fired and had been fired in the past.
An American helicopter pilot informed William Rogers, the commanding officer of Vincennes, that Iranian gunboats had fired at his helicopter. Rogers ignored the return order, moved towards Iranian territorial waters, and convinced Captain McKenna to authorize him to shoot Iranian boats. At 9:49, the Vincennes opened fire on Iranian boats.
Zero is inbound.
350 relative?
Relative. Still inbound.
The warning shots, or were they actually attacked? The helicopter wasn't hit, after all. And the helicopter could escape the area at great speed, and in fact it did. So, therefore, what was Vincennes up to in going to general quarters, accelerating to maximum speed, and heading off to those boats, which at the time presented no threat to anyone?
I did not send the Vincennes to support the Montgomery. I authorized the Vincennes to send their helo. I was the only one that was in authority to send them anywhere, and my understanding was that they had asked permission to cover the area with the helicopter and that they were also told to remain on station. Each minute at the time specified, and they were very clear-cut, that you will return fire with fire. And so they asked permission to take the units under fire. I gave permission and reported the same to Commander of Mideast Force.
In Bandar Abbas Airport, 274 passengers of Flight 655 from Bandar Abbas to Dubai boarded the plane so that pilot Mohsen Rezaian and his colleagues would fly them to Dubai. The Airbus, a passenger plane, took off at 10:16 after a short delay and was supposed to land at Dubai Airport in 28 minutes.
During that engagement with the small boats, the aircraft lifts off from Bandar Abbas and then proceeds on course, essentially, slightly off schedule, as has been noted. I think they were 20 minutes or so behind schedule, climbing on a fixed course, using the proper IFF and so forth and so on.
The Vincennes sailed into Iran's territorial waters in pursuit of Iranian boats by 10:22 and violated maritime law.
Officer Deck, presently hold the ship, crossing the Iranian declared war zone line.
We did take the 12-mile limit seriously. Everybody was very concerned about it. Incurring into the 12-mile limit was verboten, and people were supposed to hold short of this 12-mile limit by several miles to prevent that from happening.
Aircraft was proceeding on a course that would take it directly over the Vincennes position. Recall again that Vincennes was in the middle of a gun battle with these small boats. Now, perhaps a battle of its own making, but firing nonetheless.
When I briefed in with the commander of the Mideast Force, I know that a very serious concern of his, as a matter of fact, he said, Dick, the one thing that I am concerned about is shooting down a civilian aircraft.
The Iranian passenger plane was ascending when the Vincennes crew saw it on the radar screen. The Airbus A300 passenger aircraft did not look like the F-14 Tomcat. A passenger plane is much larger compared to a fighter plane, and it also flies slower. However, the Vincennes crew believed that they had mistaken this giant plane for a tiny F-14 Tomcat.
I was told that it was an F-14. I watched it. I took a look at its altitude and its speed. It was climbing. It was slow. It was in the middle of our missile envelope. The F-14, to my knowledge, had no significant anti-surface warfare capability, so I designated this thing in my own mind as a non-threat. Captain Rogers, on the other hand, involved with his gun battle at that time, announces that he is intent on taking that aircraft out at 20 miles. It's climbing, it's slow, it doesn't respond. It's in the middle of our missile envelope, basically. It's vulnerable. Why would this aircraft present a threat that did not meet any of the threat parameters that were? If Captain Rogers believed it was a military aircraft, and if he believed, as we think he did, that it was part of a coordinated effort at that point, a coordinated attack, then in his mind, he could see this as a threat.
Tense. It did make the situation much more complicated.
Both ships had attempted to communicate with the aircraft, and we were unsuccessful. We got no response back.
We could hear the challenges go out on military air distress and the civilian version of the air distress channels. So we were aware that they were warning an aircraft, an approaching aircraft.
Typically, if you could not communicate with an Iranian airplane, military aircraft, you illuminated them with your fire control radar, you let them know that you were there, and they would generally depart the area. When we illuminated it with our fire control radar, it didn't react.
I did not have the capability to talk directly to the commanding officer of Vincennes, simply because he was engaged on a very personal basis in a fight. And I knew they were about ready to pull a trigger on a missile that could kill my pilots, and I wanted to make absolutely certain that they didn't become the victim.
Air hostile at 004, true, 21 miles.
The aircraft crosses the 20-mile mark, and he doesn't shoot it down. At that point, I breathed a sigh of relief, thinking that, okay, he has now seen that it is a non-threat.
Size is right here?
Size.
Okay.
What I'm told transpired during that period of time afterwards is that they weren't capable of getting the shot off in an orderly fashion. So although the intent was to shoot it down at 20 miles, they sort of bungled the operation.
William Rogers, the commanding officer of Vincennes, requested a permission from the command center to open fire on the Iranian fighter jet. The soldiers and crew members of the Vincennes cruiser became increasingly nervous when they heard about a possible attack by the Iranian fighter jet, and fear fell upon them all. The Iranian passenger plane was ascending, though a fighter jet does not need to get high to attack an aircraft, and it is capable of attacking the target so quickly. The passenger plane sent the codes that indicated it was not a fighter aircraft, and they could identify the aircraft based on the communications between the pilot and the watchtower. However, the commanding officer of Vincennes said they received no codes from the passenger plane, so that he decided to shoot down the plane. A few minutes later, 18th minute into the flight, the passenger plane disappeared from the Vincennes radar screen, and the crew of the American cruiser started embracing each other. They did not know that their happiness would soon fade away, and that was the bitterest day of their lives, the bitterness of which would always remain in their minds. A few meters away, there were 108 women and children among the 290 people who were killed. An eyewitness says, while collecting the bodies of the passengers, we saw a woman who had hugged her child. She was hugging her so tight, the baby was stuck in her arms. We would not separate them. A child who had thought it would take less than half an hour to get off the plane at Dubai Airport.
We had individuals who were up in places where they could see wreckage falling, they could see the airplane coming down. It wasn't until sometime later that they described the wreckage in terms that led us to believe that it was not a military aircraft. It was too much, too large.
An Iranian Airbus is presumed crashed. Please look for survivors or aircraft wreckage.
I killed over the entire force. They spent a considerable amount of time. There was nothing there. And it's also fairly ironic that the Vincennes is the one that came upon the wreckage when it started to become apparent that this was an airliner that was involved. it was just a sickening feeling for the entire rest of the day. I can't ever remember being so dismayed, so depressed, so feeling for all of the people that were involved. It wasn't a very happy day in the Gulf for us, that's for sure. The Sides was dispatched to go close to the Dubai to see if they could find wreckage. And
firstly, the Americans announced that they had shot down an Iranian F-14 Tomcat. And once the truth came out, they claimed that the Iranian plane had deviated from the flight path and had ignored all 7 radio warnings issued from the Vincennes. Later on, it became clear that the Iranian plane was ascending along a legal flight path. 4 years after the incident, the New York Times wrote, "It was a Vincennes cruiser that illegally crossed into Iranian territorial waters. However, American officials have covered it up."
After receiving further data and evaluating information available from the Persian Gulf, we believe that the cruiser USS Vincennes, while actively engaged with threatening Iranian surface units and protecting itself from what was concluded to be a hostile aircraft, shot down an Iranian airliner over the Straits of Hormuz. The U.S. government deeply regrets this incident. Given the threatening flight profile and the decreasing range, the aircraft was declared hostile. Vincennes fired 2 standard surface-to-air missiles, at least one of which hit at an approximate range of 6 miles. An examination of the events on 3 July leads quickly to the conclusion that Iran must share the responsibility for tragedy and the investigation so found. By any measure, it was unconscionable to ignore the repeated warnings of the United States and permit an airliner to take off from a joint military-civilian airfield and fly directly into the midst of the ongoing surface action in the Strait of Hormuz, which the Iranians themselves had initiated.
The United Nations Security Council, July 16, 1988. An emergency meeting was held at the request of the Iranian representative to the United Nations to review the incident of the passenger plane being shot down. Iran's foreign minister and U.S. representative George W. Bush spoke at the meeting. Bush told Mr. Velayati, "This would not have happened if you had stopped fighting the war." He continued, "Minister, I am telling you that you need to choose between ending the war and confronting us." The war had become painfully torturous for the Iranians, and Resolution 598 was accepted 2 days after the Security Council meeting and the Airbus incident. On July 20th, 2 days after the adoption of the United Nations Security Council resolution on the crash of a passenger aircraft, a resolution was issued. A resolution that only expressed regret about the occurrence of that incident and included a few general statements in its other paragraphs. It also contained some recommendations concerning the prevention of future incidents and supporting research by the International Civil Aviation Organization. Iran simultaneously requested an emergency meeting from the Security Council and asked the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO, to initiate the investigations. However, the final report of the ICAO was nothing beyond the Security Council's statement. They condemned the incident and offered some ethical recommendations.
Everybody interviewed in the combat center said that the plane was descending toward the Vincennes. But the electronic record shows it never descended toward the Vincennes. But everybody had that view. I mean, they totally deluded themselves as to the nature of the threat.
Later on, Iranians filed a formal complaint with the International Court of Justice at The Hague. The results of the Security Council meeting and the ICAO investigations had already shown that there would be no better ending to this case in The Hague as well.
"Perhaps at the time of the ICAO release, we should have declassified the ship's position and issued a press release pointing out Vincennes' location within Iranian waters at the time of firing."
I spent an immense amount of time, probably the bulk of my time, looking at all the tracks and the various documentation that had been done on the tracks, and how uncertain that evidence is
How do you explain, Admiral, the discrepancy that everything started in response to distress calls, and yet the Fogarty report later confirmed that it turned out that there were no distress calls?
I don't think I can explain, Congressman. I think he misspoke.
Mr. Fogarty?
Yes. I've talked to him about it. He doesn't remember it. I cannot reconcile it. The
reason why there was no final report is exclusively my fault. We didn't produce any further document, although we wanted to, and I got bogged down with something else that erupted. I forget what it was. The biggest problem you have in doing any investigation is the guy who commits the mistake, or whether it be an honest error or whether it be a grievous error, lies to his superiors to cover his own butt.
The commanding officer and crew members of the Vincennes cruiser received the U.S. Navy Medal of Honor once they completed their mission in the Persian Gulf. The passenger plane's case was closed after the agreement. However, history still remembers it, and every year people honor the memory of the travelers who never arrived at their destination.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned.
مثلا شما قرآن حفظی منم میتونم حفظ کنم خب میرم یاد میگیرم
There are some powers or talents which are attainable. For instance, we all can memorize the Holy Quran or we can all earn a living. However, there are some features which are specific to people. For example, a person is more beautiful than others, or a person is born healthy and another one crippled. A person is grown up in a wealthy family, whereas another one is born in a poor one. Being born as a man or woman is also in the hands of Allah. We do not have the power to change them.
ام سلمه آمد پیش پیغمبر گرامی اسلام
Once Umm Salama came to Prophet Muhammad and asked him about the main reason for difference between men and women. Then Ayah 32 of Surah An-Nisa was revealed, which states, "Do not covet the advantage which Allah has given some of you over others. To men belongs a share of what they have earned, and to women a share of what they have earned. And ask Allah for His bounty. Indeed, Allah has knowledge of all things." Based on this ayah, everything is in the hands of Allah, and the share of both men and women is given to them by Allah. In other words, we people must not compare ourselves with others, because we will be given the share of what we earn, whether it be man or woman. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him,
الجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة وصيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة وصيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Was salatu was salamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. Presently we are discussing this 168th sermon, and we are trying to understand this topic from taking reference to this sermon where Imam Ali alayhi salam gave this sermon in the start of the Battle of Siffin, where he starts with the issue of taqwa and later on develops the whole concept and then explains very important issues. And we are trying to here discuss about the fact that the leader of a Muslim ummah, of the Islamic government, is one who steers the whole, you can say, the whole ship of Islam and Muslims in the dark waves on confusion and trials and you can say fitna. Fitna is a whole, are different factors that kind of try to remove a person from the path of truth. They are aimed at, derailing the ummah from the right direction. So this guide, this ruler and this leader has to be such that can guide the communities in this darkness. And Imam Ali alayhi salam, of course, in this particular state, when he talks about taqwa in the start of the sermon, it's very important because after that advice of taqwa, he mentions an important phrase which I shall mention shortly.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam, after talking about taqwa, says an important phrase and kind of answers that question that is there in our minds, that why taqwa at this instance? Why, advise people to be pious and to observe observe God in all their actions? Why? The answer would be, وَقَدْ فُتِحَ بَابُ الْحَرْبِ بَيْنَكُمْ وَبَيْنَ أَهْلِ الْقِبْلَةِ. And Imam Ali in the sermon replies this and says that because the door has opened today for you to fight between you, for a war that has occurred between you and the people of the Qibla. That means you are fighting with someone who shares the same prayer that you pray and apparently the same belief that you have in the apparent sense. Of course, you're sharing the same practices and all. So now it becomes a bit of a difficult situation. And as you know, at the time of the Prophet, you had the slogans that would be recited, for example, would be U'lu hubal, U'lu hubal. U'lu hubal means that may hubal be elevated. Hubal was the idol, their great idol. They said, may hubal be elevated. That was their slogan. They would come and they fight with you with that slogan. And of course, it was very clear. And anyone who would want to fight such an enemy, I mean, because this guy is now, you know that he's your enemy and you can kill him or you can fight with him, you know, in a, without having any doubt or confusion in your heart. He's a clear enemy and he wants to fight you, he wants to kill you, and his intention is to destroy your religion, your faith and Islam. So you are allowed to fight in situation and defend yourself and even fight, you know, such an enemy. But now you had a group of people that would come with this slogan, who inside their hearts were not bearing or not carrying the true belief, but apparently in their mouths, I mean their words, the words they used to say, Allahu A'la wa Ajal, that Allah is the loftiest, is the highest, and is the most majestic. This was the statement they would come with. And therefore, you are now fighting such an enemy. It's a very confusing situation and it needs to be taken into consideration. And that's why it is important for us as Muslims and as Imam Ali alayhi salam has constantly repeated, and that is to take lessons from history. To take lessons from what has happened in the past to be able to decide correctly for our present and our future.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, that means when Imam Ali alayhi salam speaks about these things, when he talks about the fact that, you know, go towards history or look at history, it's not just a mere, you know, just any mere advice or, you know, a kind of encouragement so that you just get to get some general knowledge and awareness about history and about life. No, it is to show you that there are certain principles that repeat themselves, because there are certain concepts, there are certain, you can say, divine principles that govern time and history that do not change. لا يتغير ولا يتبدل. They do not change. They do not, have any kind of, difference. They are the same. They remain constant. These are constants in history. We need to understand those constants and see how they apply in our lives in different situation. And now, when you look at history, you will see a time, there are times when in a war or when people would fight, the people of truth would be in a state of fighting with the people of falsehood. Sometimes the people of falsehood would come wearing the clothes of the people of truth, the clothes of goodness. And now, when you look at this enemy in the apparent sense, definitely anyone would get confused. And for a person to be brave against a clear enemy, to come bravely, take his sword, for example, or take his whatever his weapons, and clearly fight an open enemy, that is easy. And he can also express that bravery in a very nice way, you know, because this is an apparent enemy, and he feels that I can, you know, just explode with my bravery, fight, kill. But no, there is a situation where the enemy is not clear. So here, people would not be very much, they would be reluctant to express their bravery, and therefore a lot of insight and foresight is required to be able to discern and understand and be able to take the right steps in these situations. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to always steer us out of these confusing states so that we can always be in the right direction. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
مرشد هو آية
له حين دعاه لا لامونه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Now for those who are interested in archaeology, the remains of 14 mummies have been unearthed at an ancient site in central Peru. The mummies, believed to be over 1,000 years old, include 6 children and 8 adults. The tomb containing the bodies was found at an archaeological complex about 25 kilometers from the capital, Lima. Researchers discovered other objects such as clay pots, decorated calabashes, and some knitting gears near the mummies. They believe the children and adults were sacrificed in honor of a prominent local figure whose mummified body was found last November in the same area.
A group of people who were part of his environment were sacrificed, mainly children. It's quite possible that it was his children, his wives, who were sacrificed and buried in the surroundings of the tomb, and also his servants.
Van Dalen also says the discovery provides them with the oldest evidence of child sacrifice associated with the burial of an elite character in the pre-Inca era. The city of Cajamarquia, which was built out of mud in around 200 BC, is considered as one of the largest archaeological complexes in Peru.
A miniature bull in Germany's Bavaria is proving that size does not matter, as the small bovine makes himself comfortable in his new herd at an animal sanctuary. This tiny bull had a lucky escape and was rescued from a farmer who was taking him to a slaughterhouse. The mini cow is named Napoleon and was born with a genetic defect. Just 8 months old, the diminutive bull has already reached his full size. Napoleon might be small, but he is mighty and daring, as he is not afraid of joining a herd consisting of big and huge animals.
Napoleon belongs to the Dexter breed, which produces rather small cattle anyway. They grow up to be about 1.2 meters. With his 80 centimeters, he's of course far below that. Despite his size, he feels like a complete bull and is in a good mood. He has settled in with us very quickly, which we are very happy about. He also has a lively effect on the herd.
The little bovine now lives with 100 other rescued livestock. His rescuers say he gets along with other animals and has already become friendly with another rescued cow. The Dexter is a breed of cattle first originated in Ireland. They are usually bred for high-quality meat and milk. An Indonesian man frees a crocodile of a tire that was stuck around its neck some 6 years ago. Tilly, a self-taught rescuer and resident of Central Sulawesi province, captured the reptile and cut the tie using a small saw with the help of some locals. The animal had been too smart to be trapped. Tilly says he had been tracking the reptile for weeks using a basic trap with a rope tied to a log. He used live chickens and dogs as bait to lure the reptile. The crocodile drew the sympathy of local residents who worried the tire would choke as it grows in size. Tilly says his main motive was to help animals, claiming it was not his first experience dealing with a crocodile.
Biologists in Peru release two birds back to their natural habitat after weeks of efforts to attend and conserve dozens of animals affected by an oil spill. Two birds were among some 200 animals found dehydrated and were brought to a veterinary hospital for treatment. Veterinarians, biologists, and volunteers have been leading the cleanup operation of the